Hello and welcome to Patriotic History. Today's date is Friday the 21st of October 2022 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. This is episode number 53 in our series here, and at the moment we are concentrating on British history, particularly the King Arthur and King Arthur II. And I do have with me today my regular co-host Patriot and also special guest Treefids. Patriot, how are you doing? How's life treating you?
Hey Sven, yeah, I'm very well, thanks. Yeah, it's been a chilled weekend, I think. Pretty good. Just getting back settled in home now, so.
Lovely, lovely. I'm not used to recording in the dark. It's been quite some time since I did a podcast in the dark. Most of them I record during the day. And of course, this is a pre-recorded podcast a few days before it actually airs at RadioAlbion.com. Treefids, how are you doing? Welcome back to the show. And I guess we should promote treefids.net as well, shouldn't we?
Yeah, thanks for having me, Sven. Yeah, Treefids. I'm building up the site. I'm still releasing the 100 proofs, the Israelites were white videos. Today I was just thinking, it's funny that when I was younger, I remember watching Arthur and, you know, the story, the kid's story, the cartoon. I never thought that one day I'd be doing a podcast on Arthur himself, right? And here we are, right, Sven?
Yeah, it's quite incredible, really, the way that he's made out to be this mythical character, and then they've made the cartoon out of him with Walt Disney, and people think that he's just a figment of the imagination. But there's all this evidence to show that he actually existed, and he was two different Arthurs, basically. As we went into last week, we concentrated on King Arthur I. This week, we'll concentrate on King Arthur II, and we actually have some more confirmation that white people, Europeans, are Israel. We actually have some confirmation from the 6th century of that we'll be getting into when we get to the appropriate point. And again, we're going to be using R.W. Morgan's History of the Cymry. We're also going to be using Wikipedia, and we're also going to be using Alan Wilson. And I will point out each source for the notes as we come to them. We'll start with R.W. Morgan. It says, the British Church during this era continued to extend itself on every side. It held full communion with the primitive Gallic Church. Saint Germanus and Saint Lupus, the suppressors of the Pelagian heresy, were Armoricans of the royal family of Conan, Constantine and Arthur. And this is all talking around about the 5th century, sort of about the start of 400, 420. We talked about St. Germanus before and how he put down this Pelagian heresy. Conan is a famous king. This Constantine that is being referred to here, this is Constantine III, sometimes known as Constantine II. That was the British king that was also descended from Constantine the Great. And also Arthur was from the same family. At this time, St. Patrick, the Apostle of Ireland, was born at Rose in Pembrokeshire. His first name was Malwin. He was baptized Patricius, or Patrick, ordained priest AD 425 by St. Germanus, and afterwards he was appointed bishop to the Scots, or the Irish, as they're known now, by Amandus, the Archbishop of Bordeaux. In the course of 60 years, he converted all Ireland to the faith. He died in his 121st year and was buried by St. David at Glastonbury. His father was Calpurnius, his mother Consuessa, the sister of St. Martin, Archbishop of Tours, and Apostle of Southern Gaul. Another sister of St. Martin married Gortal, Prince of the Strathclyde Britons, to whom she bore St. Ninian, the Apostle of the Southern Picts, and he founded the Cathedral of Wittem, or Candida Casa, AD 440. So there's lots there to get into, and I will point out that we do have an Albion narration on St. Patrick, pointing out the real St. Patrick, because there are three of them that the historians have managed to locate, and they say each one of them could have been St. Patrick, but there was a particular St. Patrick, and the legends are confirmed by places in place names and places in Wales. And I forget what the name of the Albion narration is, but it is there in the audiobooks section. And I think that's why R.W. Morgan says he died in his 121st year, because he may have been conflating one St. Patrick with another St. Patrick. And that's why he got this long length of his years. And I think this also shows that the saints were intermingled with royalty, and we had royalty that was also sainted, and we had saints that actually came from the royal family, quite a few of them. In fact, I think St. David was supposed to have royal blood, and we see here that sister of St. Martin married the prince of the Strathclyde. Britain's Saint Non was St. David's mother. I mean, we had whole families of saints that are still saints, that are still honoured in the Orthodox Church. And we had a lot of the time, the royalty, if the daughter would go into the church, or the son, if it wasn't the eldest son, he might go into the church as well. So this is the reason why. And also these kings, they would endow the church with lots of money because they thought that it would stand them better in the afterlife, basically. Truford, do you want to pick up on any of this about St. Patrick or St. Germanus?
Yeah, it just shows you that there was a lot of Christianity spreading, to the Germanic tribes. I imagine this was also going on in Scandinavia and Germany. It wasn't just the Catholic Church, right? There were Britons spreading it. And yeah, as you said, the royal families, they were the educated, right? They had access to teachers who could properly teach and educate. Teach them to read so they could read the scriptures, or if not, they could be recited to them. And, you know, if a royal family had a son who was going to be the prince, then maybe the second and third son, they would be more into religious study and they would then go spread the gospel. So that's probably why a lot of these are connected to royalty, right? Because if they had a large family, the other sons might be interested in this, and thanks to them, Christianity spread, right?
Yeah, I mean, we did an episode a while back where we looked at one of these saints that went all the way over to Switzerland, Wulfilas, I think his name was, and that was in the first or the second century. And a lot of these saints were coming out from Ireland and coming out from Britain, basically, and going to the continent and converting people before St. Augustine came over to Britain. I mean, as it says here, it continued to extend itself on every side, and it held full communion with the primitive Gallic Church. And this is about 150 years, I guess, after Constantine legalized Christianity in the Roman Empire. Patriarch, do you want to pick up on any of that?
Yeah, there seems to be a lot of different saints. I was just wondering how they went about actually getting such a prestigious title. Was it just that they were sort of high profile ambassadors of the faith?
Yeah, I think that was it, because, I mean, it wasn't that the Pope announced that they were saints. I mean, because the Pope wasn't, you know, the head of the church at this time. It was Anglo-Orthodox, I guess you could call it. And you had the Celtic Church and the Celtic saints. And I think they were just really good people, that miracles used to happen around them. And the people that lived around them said that guy was a saint, that guy was a saint. And that's how they came to be called Saint so-and-so, Saint Germanus. I mean, he had these miracles that followed around him. If you look at the early Celtic saints, they are full of miracles that just sound incredible today. People raising people from the dead, doing all the sort of miracles that Jesus did. Apparently, these Celtic saints, they all did similar. You've got some tales where some of them end up having their head cut off, and they're still alive afterwards, and some very bizarre things that are in there. Yeah, there's a good one, Saint Justinian. I can't remember the exact tale, but it involves women trying to lure the monks from the island, and they were being lured with these monks, and the monks themselves had a very strict master over them that was Saint Justinian, and these pirates end up killing him. But he took the monks to this island to get them away from these women that kept throwing themselves at them. It's a very bizarre story. And his head gets cut off, and where the head lands, a holy well springs up. And you also get the story of Saint David, and his mother was Saint Non, and apparently his father was royalty. And where she gave birth to St. David, in a thunderstorm, a spring of water sprung out, and that became a holy well, and that holy well is still there. And it's also in the centre of a stone circle. So you have a holy well in the centre of a stone circle where St. Non gave birth to St. David, and also at that spot they built a chapel to St. Non as well. So you've got a stone circle, you've got a holy well, and you've got a chapel. So you've got sort of three different strands of British religious belief all centred in one place, plus you have this royalty there. And it also, I mean, it really disproves this pagan idea, oh, Christianity was a religion of slaves, it's a philosophy of slaves. It was all the princes that were following Christianity and that became these early popes. I mean, the early bishops, rather. I mean, the first bishop of the church in Rome was one of the sons of the British royal family, and the church there was in the Palatium Britannicum. So it wasn't a religion of slaves, and as Truford's pointed out, you had to be educated in order to be able to understand this, and you could only be educated if you were wealthy. So it was likely that it was going to be the royal families that started this up first. Well, the Roman Emperor Anthemius, requesting aid from Uther against Euric, king of the Visigoths, Uther landed at Harve at the head of 12,000 men in AD 470. An engagement took place, but the Roman proconsul failed to effect a junction, and Uther was obliged to yield the field and retire into Burgundy. Advantage was taken of his absence by Octa and Ebusa to raise the standard of rebellion. And Octa was Hengist's brother, and Ebusa was his nephew, or it might have been the other way around. And of course, Uther is the father of Arthur, and he's also the brother of Ambrosius Aurelius that we looked into detail in the last episode. So you've got the same characters here, basically. On his return, Uther was discomfited by them at York, but afterwards defeated and took them prisoners at Dumbarton Castle. Confined to the Tower of London, they escaped by bribing the guards to Germany, collected fresh forces from the Confederation, disembarked at Yarmouth, and marching to Verulam, were there routed and slain by the Pendragon. Uther Posthumus Pendragon died at London in his 90th year, AD 500. So we have Octa and Ebusa here, and I think the last time we heard of them, they were actually put up there on the borders of Scotland to defend against the Picts. And apparently there is this Saxon genetics up there in this area that Octa and Ebusa were removed to. Truefids, any thoughts on this?
Yeah, just to what you said earlier, the Celtic saints, the Catholic Church, they tried to claim them as their own, right? But they're not. They, because the Catholic Church wasn't even on the map yet, they try and push the date later and later. So they make St. Patrick, I believe, sometimes even the 9th century, right?
Yeah, that is what happened. The Catholic Church just took over these saints, basically, and a lot of these dates got messed around with, and then you ended up getting different traditions in there and claiming that this person lived at different times. I mean, there probably was a holy man called Patrick in the 9th century, but it wasn't the St. Patrick who brought Christianity to the Irish. Patriarch, any thoughts on this?
I'm just wondering what kind of scriptures they would have been kind of reading from, obviously pre-1600s with the King James Bible. Who would have been the scribes and the epistles, would or the letters and of Paul, St. Paul, been around at this time?
Yeah, I mean, they decided on a strict format. They decided on the canon by now. They had, I think that was Constantine that said, we need to work out exactly what the canon is and what should not be included. So that had been done. I think it was Wulfilas did a Bible in the Gothic alphabet or the Gothic script. And I think we talked about that before. We also had the Vulgate at this time, which was written in Latin. And there probably was a Greek version around as well. We know that the Vulgate was around. And I think you're probably asking about letters from Paul, because originally, when Christianity came to Britain, it was brought to Britain by Joseph of Arimathea, and that was before the time of St. Paul. So St. Paul's letters weren't around at that time, and that's why when we get to Augustine, when Augustine comes over, he says that the British church had these different traditions to the Roman church. They didn't baptize. They had the date of Easter at a different date. And all of this is because it was pre-St. Paul, basically. It was the earliest form of Christianity that there was. And that was the received Christianity that the British church had from Joseph of Arimathea. We'll get to St. Augustine in a bit when we get there. So we know that they had the Latin Vulgate. We've also heard about this Bible that was written in the Gothic alphabet. I don't know if it had been translated into the vernacular by this time. Alfred the Great translated it into English or Anglo-Saxon at the time. But at this time, which is sort of 300 years before then, was it written in the Colburn alphabet? I should imagine there were writings in the Colburn alphabet. There probably were sections of it that have been translated into Colburn. And I think the idea of having it in Latin was so that wherever you went, it was the same Bible, it was the same verses, and it was said in the same language. And that's why the Roman Catholics didn't like it when the Bibles were being translated into other languages. They said, because it needs to be said in Latin. That was the language that was used at the time of Christ, was Latin. And the same Latin can be understood by different people. So it's just one language. And that's what they were concerned about, is about it being translated from that. But I think it was also, originally it may have been, the New Testament may have come about in Greek. And then there was an Aramaic version. I mean, Truefids, what do you know about the earliest Bibles and their translations?
Yeah, I'm not sure how well they had the scriptures in Britain, because it would be the Brittonic language, right? Obviously, when Arthur translated, that would have been Anglo-Saxon, so the language kind of changed because the Anglo-Saxon became more dominant, and that was essentially just the Germanic language, right? It was only when the Normans come did our language drastically change from the German and Frisian language. But I imagine they must have had something, right? And when Joseph of Arimathea came over, I don't know how well, we don't know how well he knew the scriptures or how well his understanding, but he did spread Christianity, right? Obviously, Paul really understood it well. And from his epistles, you can really learn that he was identifying all the Europeans as the Israelites. I don't know if Joseph of Arimathea was fully aware of that, but as we get to later, we're going to get a quote anyways on that, right?
Yeah, we will get into that, and we'll also get into Augustine there as well once we come to it. Well, continuing with R.W. Morgan here, Uther Pendragon was succeeded by his son Arthur, then in his 20th year. The life and career of this monarch, the most popular and widely renowned of all the heroes of ancient and modern times, belongs rather to the history of chivalry and civilization than to any one land or race. As the founder of European chivalry and the champion of Christendom against the pagan hordes of the north, he created a new era, new characters, and a new code in the military annals of mankind. His exploits and those of his marshals, more or less exaggerated, form part of the literature of almost every language in Europe and Asia. Around him and his court revolved from the 6th to the 16th century innumerable cycles of epics, martial lyrics, lays, traditional narratives, and brilliant romanzas, such as have never graced any other theme, with the sole exception of that of the ancestral city of his race, the fall of Troy divine. Arthur is known, writes an author of the Middle Ages, in Asia as in Britain. Our pilgrims returning from the East and the West talk of him. Egypt and the Bosphorus are not silent. Rome, the mistress of cities, sings his actions. Antioch, Armenia, Palestine celebrate his deeds. Not only are our own countries, but the Spaniards, Italians, Gauls, and Swedes beyond the Baltic record to this day in their books the illustrious actions of this most noble king. And I bet people were not aware of that. You think this is a guy writing in the Middle Ages, and he says that King Arthur was just known about everywhere, recorded in the history books everywhere, throughout the world, pretty much. So throughout the white world, at least. I notice he's not talking about Africa there. Truefids, any thoughts on this?
yeah, that shows how amazing the tales had really spread, right? It might have been the Britons, you know, in the north, top north, west of France, that little Brittany. They were really heavy on spreading the Arthur story, and probably because there were two Arthurs, and so he seemed even larger than life because the stories kind of got combined. That also helped spread the fame, right?
Yeah, the two ended up getting melded together. I've just remembered something else about when we were talking about the Bible and what language that was in. Alfred the Great, his Saxons didn't know how to read or write, and they had to go to the Welsh. And they had to go to St. David's and get Bishop Usher to come over to them from St. David's to teach them how to read and write, and to teach King Arthur and his court, basically. And also Usher actually wrote the life of King Alfred the Great. So that shows that the British church knew how to read and write. They knew how, they were scribes. So they must have had the Bibles in their language at that time, because that's what they were doing. Is reading and writing before the Saxons were.
And sorry, just to interject, they must have actually, thinking about it, must have known Latin, right? Because they had Romans over there. They were part of the Roman Empire. They had Roman emperors. So, of course, they must have been able, at least the royalty must have been able to read the Latin Vulgate and Bible, right?
Oh, yeah, definitely. It's just whether they had it translated into the vernacular at all, which is the question, you know, and they might well have done. Patriarch, any thoughts on King Arthur being known throughout the world, basically, by the Middle Ages?
Well, I just wonder if he was one of the main champions for cementing Christianity within Britain, if he's basically, you know, kind of settled, kind of, you know, the pagan horde to the north, basically, you know, waging war against them. You probably calmed them down, right? And they probably accepted Christianity, and I'd expect there would be a bit more of a not necessarily peace, but it would have created more of you know, a kind of a civil
civil bond between them. Yeah, Christianity did help with that. It did help with that. I mean, at this time, I think the Britons, the Welsh, saw what they were doing fighting against the Saxons as Christians against heathens. And that was the way that it was written about. So it was almost like a crusade for them, because Augustine hadn't yet come over to Christianize the Saxons. And I think when he did come, he was like, well, why haven't you been trying to convert them? Why have you been fighting the Saxons instead of trying to convert them? But the thing was, there is also a tale of Arthur going up to the Picts, and the Picts say, well, and he's fighting against them. They say, look, we're Christians. And he stops fighting against them, and they do make peace because they were both Christian tribes. And that was the good thing about Christianity. It did stop the various tribes from fighting against one another, and we were able to build up a commonwealth, and we were able to build Christendom. Whereas before that point, it was every tribe for itself, you know, and that's really one of the problems that the Welsh actually had at the end. They ended up fighting amongst themselves rather than uniting together. They had all these petty princes, and that you know, that's one of the great tragedies.
I guess that goes to show then that they understood the essence of Christianity, then to love thy brother, you know, thy kindred people. Yeah. And if they was aware of their roots through Christ, then I guess that would be a good reason not to fight. And obviously that kind of settled a lot of disputes.
Yeah, we'll definitely see that. When we get to this quote from Gildas, we'll see that in the 6th century they were referring to the nation of the Britons as Israel. Well, continuing with R.W. Morgan here, our space will only permit us to epitomise the principal events of Arthur's reign, AD 500, to 542. Arthur was born at Tintagel Castle, Cornwall. His mother was Aigra of the Cunedine dynasty of Vinodotia. He was educated by St. David at Caerleon, crowned by St. Dubricius, and within a month afterwards took the field against a fresh league of the Teutonic tribes, which had been formed on the news of Uther's demise. The war, which ensued and which was terminated by the decisive battle of Mont Badon, AD 522, was conducted on both the Christian and the pagan sides with extraordinary vigour and determination. The Angles, Jutes and Saxons, the leading tribes, appear to have literally drawn their last man from the continent, for Bede declares that their old countries were in his time, AD 700, and had long been so, deserts without a single human inhabitant. The possession of Odin's blood was, we have observed, with the Anglo-Saxon and other Gothic tribes, the indispensable condition of kingship. The greater part of the Odin lineage threw itself into this pagan crusade against Britain, carrying with them the whole physical and fanatical force of the warlike nations over whom they swayed a species of divine scepter. The Odin pedigree of these chiefs was regarded by their followers as the guarantee for success, and a certain pass to every Saxon who fell under their banner to the future joys of Valhalla. So interesting, they talk about the Odinic pedigree being a divine scepter, because when we talked about this a few episodes back, we said that this Odinic pedigree actually goes back to the tribe of Judah, which was the tribe that actually had the scepter. And I'm not sure whether R.W. Morgan was aware of that at the time. But we also see here that this battle with Arthur was fairly soon within his realm, or at least within a month after his father dying. These tribes had all got together and they'd actually emptied their old lands on the continent of them. They'd all come over here for this big battle to try and take over the island. Truefids, any thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, Denmark used to be that this is where they originally came from, right? The Angles, Jutes, Saxon. Of course, there were
Germany
yeah. became a great nation. But then the Danes took over that part. So perhaps that's how the, you know, you got the rise of the Danes, because it was emptied of the Saxons, Jutes and Angles who were coming to England, right? That's how it could have happened. But it's also interesting that they were so, you know, they really believed in this Valhalla, and that's essentially what the Israelites believed, right? That they had an afterlife. And another thing, even though Morgan keeps saying Germany, they were actually calling it Scythia, right? Bede would always refer to it as Scythia, which shows that these people were really the Scythians. And unfortunately, you kind of lose that because he's translating it to Germany, right?
Yeah, I'm not sure if it was Bede or whether it was Nennius or whether it was Gildas. One of the two, yeah, was referring to Germany as Scythia, because they were Scythians. They knew that they had actually come to Europe from Scythia. So they're continually moving, you know, they work their way in from Asia into Germany, and then from Germany into Britain. And as you say, once they'd moved out from Germany, there was that space there. And then you've got the Danes that moved in and took it. And then the Danes came into Britain after that, and then fought with the Saxons. And then we get the Normans after that. I mean, we have all these battles between these tribes, basically. Patriarch, any thoughts on this?
Just a question with regards to the deserted lands. Was that as a result of kind of going into war, or kind of the aftermath of losing a war?
That was them all heading off to Britain to back up Octa and Abusa and the Saxon tribes, basically, because Uther had died, the Pendragon. And they thought that if they all moved into Britain, they would be able to take the country. But of course, they were unable to. So I guess what happened to them is the same as what happened to Britain a couple of times. All the adults, all the alpha males and the warriors would lead following a king onto the continent, and they would leave the island unguarded. And then you'd have fights between these petty chieftains of who was going to be king. And we've heard this happen a couple of times. And it sounds like the same thing has now happened in Germany. You've got all the alpha males from the Saxons, the Jutes and the Angles, and they've headed off over to Britain because the kings died in Britain, and they want to take Britain.
I think it was actually Denmark, which would be part of Germany or Scythia. But there were other Saxons down in Germany and, you know, all across that kind of region. But the Denmark was changed to the Danes. So that's probably how it happened. There must have been an exodus of the previous people when it became inhabited by Danes and dominated by Danes.
Yeah, I mean, Denmark is close to Germany, isn't it? I think it's just at the top of Germany, so it's not very far for them to go.
Yep.
Well, to meet this formidable heathen fraternity, Arthur organised the Order of Christian Chivalry, commonly known as that of the Round Table. His companions were selected from all Christians, without distinction of race, climate, or language. And of course, what they mean by race there is what we would say nation or tribe today. They bound themselves to oppose the progress of paganism, to be loyal to the British throne, to protect the defenceless, to show mercy to the fallen, to honour womanhood, and never to turn their backs upon a foe in the battlefield. The Odin chiefs of greatest eminence were Colgrin, Baldolf, Cheldric, Curdic, Oscar, Otho, Erquin, Oslac, Elisa, Egbright, Eared. All these fell in the war. The 12 celebrated victories of the young Pendragon were as follows. First at Gloucester, second at Wigan, the combats 10 miles from the Mersey. The battle lasted through the night. In AD 1780, on cutting through the tumuli, 3 cartloads of horseshoes were found and removed. So that proves that this battle took place and lots of the horses were slain. The third battle was at Black Road, fourth at Penrith between the Loder and the Eyemot on the spot that is still called King Arthur's Castle, fifth on the Douglas in Douglas Vale, sixth at Lincoln, seventh on the edge of the Forest of Celidon, which is now Ettrick Forest at Melrose, eighth at Carguinion, ninth between Edinburgh and Leith, 10th at Dumbarton, 11th at Brixham, Torbay, 12th at Mount Badon, above Bath. The last defeat, AD 520, was so crushing that it destroyed the Saxon Confederation itself. Nor did any foreigner attempt to set hostile foot on the island again until Ida landed in AD 550 in Northumbria, 8 years after Arthur's death. From AD 520 to this latter date, such of the Saxons as were not expelled or exterminated remained in peaceful allegiance to the British throne, many of them serving in and contributing to its foreign conquests. So this explains this big gap, the 30-year gap in the Anglo-Saxon chronicle. This was the era of King Arthur, and the Saxons that were not expelled or exterminated, they ended up fighting alongside Arthur when he makes his way onto the continent. Any thoughts on that, Truefitz?
Yeah, so Ida, he would be the founder of the Mercian kingdom, which dominated, I believe, for a few centuries until the Danes came and wrecked his kingdom. And then that was the rise of Wessex, right? And Ecgbert, was it? And yeah, and Ecgbert, he had a son, and then you get Arthur. And then that's when the Wessex basically became the dominant nation, right? But this shows you when Britons had a good leader, Arthur, and you know, he was a moral leader, that they were invincible, right? But then once they start having petty fights amongst themselves, it collapses. Well, they lost it all. And then later that would happen to the Anglo-Saxons. They would be turning on each other, and then the Normans took it off them, right? It's a lesson in history.
Yeah, it really is. And also, you know, what is it? Not coveting thy neighbor's ass, you know, not looking at the next kingdom and thinking, well, I want some of that. I'm going to take some of that for myself. You know, just be happy with what you've got, because otherwise a stranger will come in and take the whole lot, and all of you will just lose everything. I do find it fascinating that they find all these evidence of these battles still there, and they've got places that are named after these battles as well. Patriarch, any thoughts?
No, not quite. I was just considering the, I know Islam was pretty much starting to take root, wasn't it, in the other side of the world. And then got some centuries later, the beginnings of the Crusades, but just trying to place things, you know, on the timeline.
Yeah, I mean, sixth century, wasn't it, Muhammad? And I guess this would have been seen like a crusade, because it was Christians against heathens. And that was the way that it was framed. And Arthur has always been portrayed as this Christian king. And it was Christian knights that came to fight for him. As it says here, from all races, I mean, what that meant was all the different races that were in Britain. The Picts, the Silurians, the Gwisei. I mean, you had all these different tribes that there were within Britain. And you probably had some on the continent that may have come to help as well from Gaul. because we were allied with a lot of these Gallic tribes. And you think about it, there's always this trouble between the Cimmerians and the Scythians. And you've got the same thing here. You've got trouble between the Cymry and the Saxons. And it's the same thing. Well, looking up this Battle of Badon, we'll move to Wikipedia and see what that has to say about it. And they start off with the references to the Battle of Badon by Gildas. The earliest mention of the Battle of Badon is Gildas's De Exidio et Conquisto Britanniae, on the ruin and conquest of Britain, which was written in the early to mid 6th century. In it, the Anglo-Saxons are said to have dipped their red and savage tongue in the Western Ocean before Ambrosius Aurelianus organised a British resistance with the survivors of the initial Saxon onslaught. Gildas describes the period that followed Ambrosius's initial success like this. From that time, the citizens were sometimes victorious, sometimes the enemy, in order that the Lord, according to his wont, might try in this nation, the Israel of today, whether it loves him or not. This continued up to the year of the siege of Badon Hill, Obsessionis Badonicae Montis, and of almost the last great slaughter inflicted upon the rascally crew. And this commences, a fact I know, as the 44th year, with 1 month now elapsed. It is also the year of my birth. And this is what Gildas has to say about it. So what he's doing there, he's actually calling Britain, the nation of Britain, the Britons, he's calling them the Israel of today. So could that be a reference to the fact that they understood that back then, that that's actually where they came from? Or was it from looking at Christianity and thinking, well, we're Christians today, so we're the Israel of today? I think he's referring to the fact that they knew that they were the Israel of today, and their stories in the Bible were talking about their ancestors. I think that's what he's referring to there. Treefords, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, you never know. You'd have to jump in a time machine and go speak to Gildas and say, did you mean like we're physically Israelites or spiritually Israelites? Because did he believe that if you believe in Christ, then you magically become an Israelite? Or did he physically believe we descend from the Israelites? And that's why, you know, you'd have to ask him, because sometimes it's vague and you wonder what he thought at the time, right?
Yeah, it's just one of those questions that we have. I mean, there are so many reports that actually refer to Britain as Israel, especially in the early Bibles, in the early King James Bibles. And it becomes very clear that they're referring to the British people as Israel. And then you look at things like the Declaration of Arbroath, and that actually times the appearance of the Scottish nation going back to the Exodus. And when you look at the Brutes, the earliest history of Britain, it's telling you what's happening in Britain, and then it's also telling you, it's saying, and at the same time, this was happening in Judea. So why would they have known what was happening in Judea at that time? Why would they have been interested in it? I mean, this is before the time of Christ. Why would they have been interested in it unless they knew that that was actually their ancestors and that was actually where they came from at that time? Petra, any thoughts on Gildas referring to Britain as the nation of Israel?
Yeah, I think the bit after it is quite telling. He says his word might try in this nation, the Israel of today, whether it loves him or not. I think that's quite telling, because it's a deep insight into the relationship and dynamic between Israel and God the Father, you see. You know, he's well aware, if they're on crusades, then he's looking to convert. And so he's aware of this kind of dynamic between Israel, some kind of stumbling on the stumbling stone, and not accepting Christ, and some that are. And it's like you said, it was clearly a crusade to unite the brotherhood, I guess.
Yeah, you can see from it very clearly that it was a Christian crusade. That was the way that it was seen. And I think they're looking at it as if we obey God, we'll win against the Saxons. And they did win against the Saxons. So obviously after that, that would reinforce the Christian message all the more, wouldn't it, in the way that they lived. And these Saxons that then came and joined them, I think they would have become Christian as well. You know, clearly they would have done, because that's what the Christian scriptures instruct them to do, with the people of their household and the people that are living with them. And obviously, the Saxons are of the same race as the Britons, so they would have they certainly would have Christianized them. And I think they would have had a Christian Commonwealth. They would have had quite a golden age after defeating the Saxons, I think, if they were sticking to these.
It's interesting.
Rules.
For some reason, this is kind of the beginning of what they will call the Dark Ages, right? And I've always been interested in to understand why they call it the Dark Ages.
Because they would rather you didn't find out about it. that's why. If you look at Alan Wilson, they say that there was no Dark Ages. That's, that's a historian's bluff today to get you not to investigate this time.
Because it seems to me like it's more like the opposite in terms of it's the establishment of Christendom, isn't it? It's when Christendom was really took root in Europe.
Yeah.
And it's fully fermented.
Well, yeah. I mean, the time of King Arthur, the time of chivalry, the Round Table, getting rid of the Saxons. We had all this technology, all this knowledge. I mean, the historians want you to think that we were just savages, basically, until the Romans came along, and then the Saxons came along and just defeated us. And that isn't what happened. I mean, as we learned from looking at the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, the Saxons didn't actually make their way out of Kent for about 100 years. And by that time, they'd become culturally pretty much the same as the Britons. There really wasn't that much difference between them. De Excidio Britanniae describes the battle as such an unexpected recovery of the island that it caused kings, nobles, priests, and commoners to live orderly according to their several vocations. Afterwards, the long peace degenerated into civil wars and the iniquity of Malguin Gwyneth. So we have confirmation there that after this battle, they lived orderly lives. They kept to Christian traditions. That Arthur had gone unmentioned in the source closest to his time, Gildas, was noticed at least as early as the 12th century hagiography, which claims that Gildas had praised Arthur extensively, but then excised him completely from his work after Arthur killed the saint's brother, Hywel Mab Cor. Modern writers have suggested the details of the battle were so well known that Gildas could have expected his audience to be familiar with them. I think it's probably more likely that Arthur killed the saint's brother, and so he wrote him out of the history. That would make sense, because that's what was said in the 12th century. So that's the earliest report that we have of this, and that's an explanation of this. So, and he wouldn't have just made that up, but that would have had to have been common knowledge, like rumours, what people knew, I think, because he does mention Aurelius Ambrosius. So why wouldn't he mention Aurelius Ambrosius's nephew, Arthur? It's just very, very suspicious that he doesn't mention Arthur in there, and that gives a reason for it, that he killed his brother. Any thoughts on that, Truefids?
By Arthur killed the saint's brother, it means Gildas's brother, right? That the writer,
yes.
And he was so enraged that he tore Arthur's story out of his historical work. That's what I imagine he means, right?
Yes, yeah. I think it is Saint Gildas. I think he was another one that was sainted. So it killed his brother. I've heard that before. I've read that elsewhere. Any thoughts on that, Patriarch?
No, not on this bit.
We're moving on to Bede. The battle is next mentioned in an 8th century text of Bede's Ecclesiastical History of the English People, the Historia Ecclesiastica Gentis Anglorum. It describes the siege of Mount Badon, where they made no small slaughter of those invaders, as occurring 44 years after the first Anglo-Saxon settlement of Britain. Since Bede places that arrival just before, during, or just after the joint reign of Marcian and Valentinian III in 449 to 456, he must have considered Badon to have taken place between 493 and 500. Bede then puts off discussion of the battle, but more of this hereafter, only to seemingly never return to it. And of course, he wouldn't want to return to it. He was the Saxon historian. It was a great embarrassment for the Saxons. And Bede's history, part of the reason for him doing that was to diminish the people that were already in Britain, to diminish the Britons and pretend that they didn't have a civilization and they were just backward savages, because it was propaganda. So he really did not want to mention this at all. So he doesn't mention very much about it. He does later include an extended account of St. Germanus of Auxerre's victory over the Saxons and the Picts in a mountain valley traditionally placed at Mould in Flintshire in northeast Wales, which he credits with curbing the threat of invasion for a generation. However, as the victory is described as having been accomplished bloodlessly, it was presumably a different occasion from Badon. Accepted at face value, St. Germanus' involvement would also place the battle around 430, although Bede's chronology shows no knowledge of this. So also, I mean, we can say that Bede wasn't quite up, he wasn't very good at his dates and the years when things were actually taking place. And also, because this victory was a bloodless one, perhaps that seemed less embarrassing to Bede than the Saxons getting a thrashing in an actual physical battle. This victory was a bloodless one, so maybe not quite so embarrassing for them. I don't know. Treefids, any thoughts on Bede?
Yeah, when you read a historian and he's all you got, then you're at the mercy of, you know, how intelligent he was, how well he researched it, but also his bias, right? That there's not many historians on this period, so we kind of just have to go with it. But yeah, he was an Anglo-Saxon. I believe he also was heavily biased towards the Catholic Church. He heavily favoured it as well, which we'll get to later, right? Where he saw St. Augustine as the good guy, right?
Yeah, that was the other side to this. He was also an agent of the Roman Church. He is also referred to as the execrable Bede. Not just the venerable Bede, but the execrable Bede by some of the Welsh, because they really did not agree with the history that he had written. Patriarch, any thoughts on Bede?
Just to point on the accomplished bloodless battle, was that as a result of them just kind of forfeiting or giving up?
Must have been something to do with diplomacy. Perhaps we'll hear about it in R.W. Morgan's summary. And let me just have a look at the dates here. I mean, he's saying 493 and 500, and R.W. Morgan is saying it was 520 was the actual date of the battle. So R.W. Morgan is saying it was 20 years later than when Bede says the battle took place. Next, we have Nennius and the Welsh Annals. The earliest surviving text mentioning Arthur at the battle is the early 9th century Historia Britonum, the history of the Britons, attributed to Nennius, in which the soldier Arthur is identified as the leader of the victorious British force at Badon. The 12th battle was on Mount Badon, in which there fell in one day 960 men from one charge by Arthur, and no one struck them down except Arthur himself. So that sounds like a bit of a tall story. But what that tells us is that, this mythology must have built around Arthur, about him being such a great man, about him being such a great warrior, that these exaggerations came in. So they said that he had killed 960 men. But the idea that there would be nobody actually called Arthur that story originated from isn't possible. I mean, it's had an exaggeration there, but the fact that it was exaggerated shows that it actually took place, I think. The Battle of Badon is next mentioned in the Annales Cambriae, the Annals of Wales, assumed to have been written during the mid to the late 10th century. And of course, they assume it was written at that time, but it was copied from earlier texts. The Battle of Badon, in which Arthur carried the cross of our Lord Jesus Christ for 3 days and 3 nights upon his shoulders or shield, and the Britons were the victors. So again, we see that it's highlighted that Arthur was Christian. And I dare say that the quotes that Wikipedia is using, they're probably trying to find the most unbelievable quotes to use from these as well, because they want to try and portray Arthur as not actually having existed. Treefids, any thoughts?
Yeah, Wikipedia are known for doing that, right? And nobody's allowed to edit them. If you try and like just give an honest quote, it never gets approved. It's very known that it's very biased. And what have you also noticed, how they purposely separate actual history, you know, like Nemanius and that they don't put it in any of like the Roman history, you have to search for it separately yourself, especially like, you know, the history of Britain and all that. They never put it in with any of the history. They always have these separate Wikipedia articles that are kind of hidden and buried, but only if you actually search for them yourselves will you find them, right?
Yeah, there's no cross-referencing at all with the British histories. They want to hide that, basically, and pretend that it doesn't exist. Patriarch, any thoughts on Nennius and the Welsh annals here?
No, not quite. I'm just taking it in.
Well, moving on to Geoffrey of Monmouth. Geoffrey of Monmouth's circa 1136 Historia Regum Britanniae, the history of the kings of Britain, was massively popular and survives in many copies from soon after its composition. Going into much greater detail, Geoffrey closely identifies Badon with Bath, including having Merlin foretell that Badon's baths would lose their hot water and turn poisonous. He also mixes in aspects of other accounts. The battle begins as a Saxon siege and then becomes a normal engagement once Arthur's men arrive. Arthur bears the image of the Virgin, both on his shield and his shoulder. Well, that ties in with this earlier one from the Welsh annals, doesn't it? That he carried the cross on his shoulders or shield. So, and it's saying here that it was a symbol of the Virgin on his shield and his shoulder. So he was definitely a Christian. This was definitely seen as Christians against heathens. Arthur charges and kills 470, 10 more than the number of Britons that were ambushed by Hengist near Salisbury. As you remember, the Night of the Long Knives, where the Saxons pulled out their knives and killed all the chivalry and all the princes of Britain. So Arthur kills 10 more than the Saxons killed at that on the Night of the Long Knives. Elements of Welsh legends are added. In addition to the shield Peredwin, Arthur gains his sword Caliburnus and his spear Ron. Geoffrey also makes the defence of the city from the Saxon sneak attack a holy cause, having Dubricius offer absolution of all sins for those who fall in battle. And that's typical of Wikipedia. They try and say that it's Geoffrey of Monmouth that made this into a holy cause, but we've seen every historian so far has made mention of the fact that it was a holy cause, going all the way back to the 6th century with Gildas. That was the way that it was seen. Arthur was a Christian king. This wasn't something that was just invented by Geoffrey of Monmouth. Truefid, any thoughts on that or any final thoughts on the Battle of Badon?
Well, yeah, I mean, the invaders, Saxons were pagans and Arthur was Christian. The Britons were Christian. So, of course, it would be seen as, you know, a Christian crusade, right? But I think where the history of the kings of Britain makes out that it was the Virgin Mary, that shows that the Catholic Church had become a lot more influential in Britain by that time, because they venerated Mary, right? Whilst the original Britons probably didn't. They just, you know, how it should be, just Christ only, and you don't venerate people up with Christ. And there's even the legend that Joseph of Arimathea brought Mary, the mother of Christ, over with him to Britain, you know? So clearly she was just a normal, ordinary woman, right?
Yeah, that's a really good point. And also at the time of Constantine, when Helen of the Cross went out to Jerusalem, she came back with a piece of the cross. She came back with nails of the cross. There wasn't anything linked with Mary or the Virgin at that point. Patriarch, any thoughts?
Just thinking about the Saxons, and they're quite resilient in terms of embracing the faith, and they've always seemed to be the most underhand so far of a lot of the different tribes and clans, especially since, if I recall one of Truthvid's videos with the sons of Sake, is kind of embedded in their name. It's quite ironic that they seem the most resilient.
They were. I mean, if you look at the histories, as R.W. Morgan said, I mean, even the Anglo-Saxon historians will say that they really were not a nice bunch of people. I mean, talk about stabbing people in the back. I mean, the history of going to a peace conference and going into a stone circle, and you had to leave your weapons, and you certainly couldn't fight within the stone circle because it was a holy place. But that was the same in the churches. You know, you go into a church, you would have sanctuary. And this tradition that they had of going into these stone circles to make peace was a tradition that all the tribes on the continent had. And they'd had that for thousands of years. I mean, the Romans would honour this. I mean, we did a really early episode about Brennus and Belinus and also the Molmutine laws. And you can see from that, these laws that they had, these were sort of obeyed by all these tribes. And then you have these Saxons that come in that just completely ignore all these rules and of civilization and just go totally out of bounds and kill all the princes. But then once they do become Christian, they become absolutely fantastic. You know, the reign of Alfred the Great is fantastic. And they were really good for a couple of hundred years. And they had a golden age. It's a really good example of how Christianity helped the Europeans, about how it turned European tribes. It also helped them to come together as a nation and gave them a shared identity. And then they were able to build Christendom. The Saxons are a really, really good example of it, because all the references to them, they say they were good warriors, but they were absolute backstabbers, and they didn't know how to read and write. They were absolute savages, basically. And once they became Christian, they became quite central to the civilization. Well, if we move back to R.W. Morgan now, and he's talking about Arthur. Arthur's just defeated the Saxons at Mount Badon. And he says, the only portion of France unsubdued by Clovis and his Franks was Brittany, now ruled over by Hoel, the cousin and subject of Arthur. And if we remember, Uther and Ambrosius were over in Brittany, and it was the king from Brittany, or the cousin of the king in Brittany, that was Constantine, that came over to be the king of Britain, that Arthur was actually descended from. So Brittany was very, very close to Britain, and at times it was ruled over by Britain. So reviving, as the Henrys and the Edwards were wont to do in later ages, the claims of his predecessors to the Gallic dominions, Arthur, in 5 years, AD 521 to 526, achieved the conquest of Gaul, Clodomir, the successor of Clovis, falling in the great battle on the plain of Langres. And what he's talking about here, the Edwards will want to do in later ages, that was Edward Longshanks. He had a realm over there in Brittany that he paid a lot of attention to, and he built a lot of villages there. And the fact that it says here that Arthur killed Clodomir, the successor of Clovis, that has to be recorded in the continental history. So whoever it was that killed Clodomir, that was Arthur, basically. Arthur was crowned at Paris the same year that Justinian succeeded to the Eastern Empire. So we had the Eastern Roman Empire and the Western Roman Empire. Eastern Roman Empire was the Byzantine Empire. The conquests of the mother countries of the pagan nations themselves followed. From AD 527 to 535, Old Saxony, Denmark, Frisia, North Germany, and the whole of Scandinavia, as far as Lapland, were subdued in succession. Johannes Magnus, the Archbishop of Uppsala, the historian of ancient Denmark, charges Arthur with having ruled these three northern conquests with excessive rigour. From AD 535 to 541, the Arthurian Empire extended from Russia to the Pyrenees, and it enjoyed undisturbed repose. So there we go. We have the historian of ancient Denmark, which says that Arthur ruled Scandinavia, basically, at this point. Milan, 2 years before it had been taken by the Goths, and 300,000 citizens, every male adult, put to the sword by the brutal captors, in order to liberate Italy and add it to the Christian Empire of Britain, Arthur conducted his forces again to the continent, leaving his insular dominions under the regency of Mordred, the eldest son of his sister Anna or Morgana, and Clu Cunvarc or Lotho, the king of Scotland. The name of Mordred stands out in unenviable prominence as that of the third arch traitor of the Isle of Britain. So Milan had been taken by the Goths, so he then heads over to Rome to liberate Milan from these Goths. And at this time, he had everything from Russia to the Pyrenees, as confirmed by Johann Magnus. Any thoughts on this, Truthfids?
Yeah, I guess this bit I'm a little bit suspicious, because I haven't read this anywhere. I know in the history of the Britons, he does say that, you know, Arthur got this far, but I haven't read it anywhere else. So I'm just wondering, I'd love to get his sources of this, because this is pretty amazing if Arthur did achieve this, right? Because this would be the last great British empire which reached onto the continent as well, right? Until like the Normans took France again.
Well, I would say what he's probably using Geoffrey of Monmouth's history. He's probably also using the Welsh histories. And he's tying that in with this confirmation here. I mean, Johann Magnus is saying that, he had those three northern conquests. So he had Scandinavia as far as Lapland. He had North Germany. He had Denmark. So that and Russia is down there past the Baltics, isn't it? So he's basically saying he had the Baltics down to the Pyrenees. So he had he'd already taken Gaul as well. So he's had it confirmed by this Johann Magnus, basically.
I just I had the History of the Franks next to me because I've got the book. I just quickly checked Clodomir, and he has Clodomir's killed by Godomir, another rival king in France. So I don't know. According to Gregory of Tours, he says Clodomir died another way, but then Gregory of Tours lived a few centuries after that. So I'm not, I just thought I'd mention that anyways, you know.
Well, it might not have been Arthur himself that actually slew the king. It might have been a king that, or princes that were fighting in his army. Because don't forget, when he wasn't just doing this with the Britons, he had the Saxons that had come in to join him, and he would have had the Gauls that came in to join him as well, the ones that wanted to have a British king. Because don't forget, they had Brittany, they had that area, and they had these allies from that area anyways, as we've seen from centuries back. So, I mean, that could be where that came from. It may have been that it was this other king that killed him, but the one that actually ruled was Arthur. At this point, because you also had kings that would swear fealty to other kings, and they would do homage to them, and they would have to pay a certain amount of tribute, and basically what they were is they were still a king, but they were underneath another king. So we had all of that was going on as well. I mean, that's the reason why Edward I fell out with the princes of Wales, because they were supposed to do homage to him, and they ended up not doing what they were told. And you've got the same situation that that happens over there in France. Patriarch, any thoughts on this great conquest of King Arthur?
It's kind of up there with the likes of Alexander the Great, almost, isn't it, really, in what he's done. And yeah, especially if he's spreading Christianity, he's doing a service to the rest of Europe, really, in the long run.
Yeah, don't forget that, you know, they've already said that you've got confirmation from this, from the Bosphorus and from Anatolia and from Egypt and from all these countries, all these other countries are all talking about this, and they're all confirming this. Right, as we got to here, he's now headed off to Rome, and we've now got Mordred, who stands out in unenviable prominence as that of the third arch traitor of the Isle of Britain. And I'm just wondering whether we should leave it there for now, and we'll get into what happened with Mordred in the next episode, I think. Any final thoughts on today that you want to bring up before we finish, Treefids?
Yeah, I was just thinking if this would explain why he would be so famous if he had reached all of the continent. And as you said, if in the next bit, it's going to tell you that he got to the Alps, we'll get to that. But it shows you that he must have had dominion over people in Germany, and that's how his empire reached that far. But just this last bit on the traitors, who were the three traitors then? You had the first one with Julius Caesar, right? Mordred, this is the third. Who was the second one then? Sorry, Sven.
I think it was probably the queen, Cartis Mandua, who handed Caractacus over to the Romans, or Caradoc, right, over to the Romans, because he went up there to get that tribe to join his alliance with the Silurians in fighting against the Romans, and she drugged him, bound him in chains, and handed him over to the Romans. And I think she was the queen of the Iceni. And then she got her comeuppance, because this Seneca, the usurer, ended up loaning money to that tribe to her father or to her descendants or whatever, and they ended up getting in debt to them. And then when they couldn't pay the debt, when the father died, the Romans went in there and raped Boadicea's sisters or what have you, and that was the cause of the Boadicean rebellion. And it was that same tribe, so they were. They didn't do well afterwards. After selling out to Caractacus, they really didn't do very well, and they were very badly treated. But yeah, I think you'll find it was Cartus Mandua was the other traitor, and the first one was Mandu Bratius, I think was his name, Mandu Bratius, and he was the one that sold out Casualon to the Romans, as you pointed out, to Julius Caesar, and he was one of the London tribes, I think. So those are the three arch traitors that are mentioned in the triads. Patriarch, any final thoughts on today that you want to bring up before we finish?
I'm just wondering who's shaping up to be the best Arthur, the first Arthur we spoke of, or this one. I think this guy seems to be this Arthur seems to have done more so far.
Yeah, I think the second Arthur has done more. But I think what I'll have to do is I'll do some more research into this, because I've got some of other of Alan Wilson's books, and I'll have a look and see what he has to say about Arthur taking this part on the continent. Because I'm sure I have heard it before, but I need to do some more research on it so we can find out where R.W. Morgan is getting his information from. But I also think Arthur I, I mean, he did pretty similar. I mean, he was known as the King of Greece. And he conquered all of Gaul and Rome, and because he was famous for defeating the Romans and becoming the equivalent of the Emperor of Rome, because his father was the Emperor of Rome, wasn't he? Maxen Waledic. So what you've got is, and again, you've got Arthur II, who does the same thing, makes his way across the continent and takes over all these countries. So the two legends ended up melding together. I will try and find some more out about this for next week. So it is an opportune moment to finish here, I think, for today. So
they share the same line, right?
Yeah, I mean, Arthur II was he six generations after Arthur I, or maybe less than that?
Yeah,
from the same family, and also from the same family as Constantine the Great, and then going all the way back to Brutus from Troy. It's this same family line. I mean, even going up to the 12th and the 13th century, you still got princes of Wales that their claim to nobility was the fact that they were descended from Brutus. You probably still got some of them around today. It'd be great to meet them. I mean, this is one of the reasons why they don't want people to understand this history, because it says that there was a nobility that's been deprived, basically, of their natural rights. I mean, they're probably people that are not living very wealthy lives today, I would have thought. But it's uncomfortable history for the regime, basically, and it's also uncomfortable history for the Roman Catholic Church, because it shows that Christianity really took off in Britain like years before it took off in Rome, and the first church in Rome was the British Church in Rome. And it shows that before the Romans came, we had a history. Before the Saxons came, we had a history. And, there's a lot of evidence to show that this history is accurate. There's more evidence to show that this history is accurate than there is to show that history of parts of Roman history was accurate. And yet they don't rubbish the Roman history and say, oh, well, that's all myths and legends. They say, well, that's accurate history. And if you've got places that are named after these battles, and you've got Welsh king lists which tell you that these people existed, and you can work out the date of when they existed, and you've got people that say, well, that was my ancestor, then clearly these people did exist. And we'll get into that later on. Anyway, when we look at Alan Wilson's work on this, he comes up with a lot of the evidence for where these people were buried, where these battles took place, how they worked out, who Arthur II was. So we won't just have R.W. Morgan's evidence here. We'll also hear Alan Wilson's. And I'll try and find out more about what happened in this particular historical period. I'll try and find it out from the alternative historical sources as well before the next episode. But I do think we should leave that here for now, though. So thank you very much for coming on today, Truthfits.
Thanks for having me, as always, Sven. Always a pleasure.
Thanks very much for coming on today, Patriarch.
Thank you. Been fun.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next week with more patriotic history for you. And of course, we do hope you have a great weekend ahead of you.